Ever wonder if there's more to the movies you love? Do you like to ponder how they got from A to Z? Who chose the plot twists? Why use those characters? Is there a deeper meaning? We're here to explore those questions and maybe learn a bit along the way. VGB Studios proudly presents The Filmlosophers.
Hello and welcome to another exciting episode of The Filmlosophers, the show that gets into the movies you love and digs a little deeper
into a hole.
Yeah, well, I had to make it sound like there was more people here than just two, because this is our first episode without Chad. So we are going to make sure everything is at 110%, because we are still going to have a great time, aren't we, Spence?
Oh yeah, most def.
With me as always is Mr. Spencer Out of This World Williams. I was going to say Riley. I was going to say Williams.
Keep doing that. It's been like over a year.
I miss him.
You were doing that when he was still on the podcast. No difference.
We got a great show in store for you, as we're going to be talking about the recently dropped latest film in the franchise of Men in Black, Men in Black International. So stick around as we talk about that. But before we do, Spencer, do your new duties.
No matter what alien race is threatening to destroy Earth, you can always be sure that the Filmlosophers podcast will be brought to you by Mingle Media TV and VGB Studios.
That it will.
New episodes are recruited to your device each Wednesday morning and stream on Spotify, iTunes, Google Play, Stitcher, Libsyn, Player FM, and Audio Boom. Find your place in the universe is a tough journey, so why not start with something smaller? Say, connecting with us on socials?
Why not?
Connect with us on Facebook at facebook.com/filmlosophers and on Twitter at twitter.com/philosophy101. Finally, we know it sucks getting neuralized, but our memories aren't that great either. I have a hard time recalling what I even did this last weekend.
We were just talking about that.
But hey, when it comes to episodes, we've got just a place for you to go. You can access our entire list of episodes at filmlosophers.com.
That's right. We have over 160 episodes on our website. You can check us out. We have everything from the recent conversation we had about Godzilla versus Godzilla King of Monsters, mm-hmm. to Brightburn, to everything under the sun. These past few years, we've tried to cover it, including a couple of great conversations we've had. So check us out. Let us know what you think on all of those. But you are here to listen to our conversation about the latest movie coming out this weekend, Men in Black International. Now, needless to say, this is not the Men in Black that you're used to. There's no Will Smith or Tommy Lee Jones, although we do have a little bit of Will Smith here today.
I've missed 90s Will Smith.
Just a little disclaimer. This was Spence's idea to use this
song. It was.
I'm like, you know what? The great Danny Elfman did the score for this movie. It should be good. Let's find a good one. Let's find Will Smith's Men in Black song.
Okay.
I'm like,
to be fair.
The one that was bumping in everybody's car during the mid-90s when that song came out.
That's the song you associate with this movie franchise.
Just because it's called Men in Black?
No, because like the whole song is about the Men in Black. This came on the DVD. I see the musical.
It was at the end of the movie. I remember that. So, we're going to be talking about the latest entry into that saga and give you our thoughts, because it's going to be pretty skewed. Honestly, we haven't talked about it yet, so I'm interested in hearing Spence's thoughts. So, before we do, Spence, why don't you give us that official synopsis goodness?
Tell me I had to read this.
Oh, poor baby.
The Men in Black have always protected the Earth from the scum of the universe. In this new adventure, they tackle their biggest, most global threat to date, a mole in the Men in Black organization.
Ooh.
Directed by F. Gary Gary.
Are you going to take that part too?
Oh, am I not supposed to?
I usually grab that, but hey.
Okay, no, you go. I don't want to step on your toes.
We're treading new grounds today, folks. Directed by F. Gary Gray and executive producer Steven Spielberg, this film stars Chris Hemsworth, Tessa Thompson, Kumail Nanjiani, Rebecca Ferguson, Rife Spall, Lauren Burgess, Larry Burgess, who are twins, and it also includes Emma Thompson and Liam Neeson. This film does mark the only Men in Black film to not be directed by Barry Sonnenfeld, which is unique because Barry Sonnenfeld actually did the first three in consecutive order. Like, those are all him. So this film has a different viewpoint in terms of, or a different vision, if you will, for the finished product because it's a different director. A couple of the numbers. The budget of this film was $110 million, which is surprising because for it being so heavy, CG heavy, I actually was kind of surprised that that's the estimated budget of this film. Domestic opening weekend, it did do $30 million, so domestically, but its worldwide totals as of today, so as of the day that we are recording, worldwide totals are in the area of $106.5 million.
Okay.
So that's not bad. I mean, it's getting up there.
Yeah.
So like we said, this is a new entry in the Men in Black saga, if you will, because it's not, you can't just continue to call it a franchise. Now that the MCU have begun to birth new ground with calling their portions of stories within their film universes sagas, this is the Infinity Saga and whatnot, we can say that this is now the Men in Black saga.
Oh my gosh.
Well, I take that back. Marvel didn't do it first. You're looking at like Star Wars. Star Wars did it first. Because that's...
Wait, who calls it the Star Wars saga?
Everybody who knows Star Wars? I mean, that's really not a... It's not really a question, is it?
I've never really heard it that way.
Because anybody... Well, if you look at anybody who has followed the storyline, it has always been the saga, if you will. The Old Republic saga, or the, you know, pre, you know, Rebellion era saga, or you have the post, you know, Empire saga, you know.
Oh.
There's a whole thing.
Okay.
We may have to do a whole episode on that just to school you.
Let's not.
Yeah.
Because that requires Jar Jar being in there at some point.
I thought you liked Jar Jar.
Who likes Jar Jar? Like
the actor who played him, maybe? I don't know.
Yeah, he posted a video and it was real sad.
Was it in between his shifts at, you know, Church's Chicken or something?
No, it was like about how people kept making fun of him and it was really hurtful.
Well, seeing as we're back, we're talking about Men in Black. Chad, where are you? No. So in this particular franchise of a film, this is a new entry. It's not supposed to be continuing the original trilogy, if that's what you want to call it. It's actually a furthering of the universe, the story within the universe. So it's more of like a spin-off. It's kind of like what Hobbs and Shaw is doing within the Fast and the Furious franchise, I think is the best way to put it.
Okay.
What do you think?
I think Hobbs and Shaw looks more interesting comparatively.
That's very true, because I'm not looking... So that's one of the other things that you and I, Spencer, are going to have to do. I'm going to have to sit you down and make you watch all the Fast and the Furious movies and see the progression as to how
just
it goes.
I just want to say this is so meandering. We were talking about everything else.
I swear we're going to get to the movie. But no, I mean, this franchise has been around for a little while. Like, if you want, if you look, like, do you know when the first Men in Black movie came out?
Wasn't it like 96, 97?
It feels like it was. But it's one of those movies where it's like, it kind of epitomizes that generation. It was 1997, yeah.
Yes.
It epitomizes that generation of, like, kind of seeing, like, the cool space movies and, you know, having fun actors in their films.
This is because this is the year, like, Men in Black came out the year before Independence Day. So, like, that was kind of like, you know, like, when a bulk of, like, aliens and space, like, type movies came out.
Yeah. It's true, because, like I said, Independence Day, and then you had Men in Black, and then there was everything else that began to follow suit after the fact. I mean, it was an interesting movie because you had a household name such as Will Smith, who had already begun gaining notoriety.
Yeah, especially since that's like right off of Fresh Prince too for him.
Oh, yeah. Yeah, completely. To see him in a major motion film and actually watch him on the big screen, it's kind of that unique perspective, I guess you could say, for a lot of people who have seen the progression of an actor's career. You know, I guess it's kind of like the same thing of like how people back in the day used to see other people on TV and watch them go to a movie. I don't know anybody else who's done that. But nevertheless, it was an opportunity to see somebody who we had grown up with while watching Fresh Prince of Bel-Air make the jump to the big screen and be in a really fun and unique movie. So
yeah.
And to top it off, he got to do the song, the main song for the film. So I guess
bonus. Like back then, that was like a no-brainer because like it's Will Smith. Like he did, he was like a jack of all trades back then. Movies, music, TV.
It's very true.
That's a trifecta right there.
The unique thing about this particular movie, jumping back into this story, did you know that this was actually supposed to be like a collaboration, like a mesh between two franchises in this movie? Like it wasn't just supposed to be a Men in Black movie.
Oh.
So at one point in time, they were actually talking about making this a Men in Black and 21 Jump Street collaboration movie.
What?
Yeah, they were talking about this way back when. They were like, oh, yeah, our next movie, when it comes out, our next 21 Jump Street is actually going to be, you know, this mashup with Men in Black, and they're the two, you know, franchises are going to come together, and the, you know, Channing Tatum and Jonah Hill or whatever his name is, they're going to be, you know, in the whatever, blah, blah, blah. That would have been interesting. I'm glad they didn't go in that direction.
That sounds insane. Like, having some movie come out, like, what is it going to be called, 23 Men in Black Street or something? Like, that's just doing too much.
23.
That's
yeah. Apparently, it says that the studio was angling to make a crossover film mixing the Men in Black and 21 Jump Street franchises. They were supposed to be making actually a few of them. So, but apparently it didn't work out because the producer refused to compromise on the financial arrangement for the films.
Huh.
So instead, they just went with the Men in Black international storyline. Which, thank God, that's what happened.
Huh.
So, talking about this particular movie, in terms of, like, information and whatnot, I'm going to be pretty frank. I've seen so I did homework. No, you know, surprise to anybody.
Yeah.
I saw the first and the third one again, but I didn't see the second one because I don't like the second one.
Like, I'm on that boat with
you. I cannot stand the second one to an nth degree, like, to the furthest, like, I can watch the beginning and maybe part of the end, but everything in the center is like garbage to me. Like, I just can't stand it. The fact that they got, what's his name from Jackass? What's his name?
I don't remember this movie, so
Johnny
I
Knoxville.
Help you.
He was in Men in Black 2. He was the guy with the second little head that came out of the side of him.
Oh, that's him?
Yeah, you don't remember them?
No, huh. Well, it's also, you know, that was a long time ago.
Well, it wasn't that long.
It was 2002, man. I was in high school.
See? Look, that's... See?
Huh. Yeah, that is him.
That's horribly him, unfortunately. But there was another form of information that I used to actually kind of garner some of my information about the film franchise and do my research.
Wikipedia?
No. Actually, the Men in Black cartoon.
I was say Bitcoin.
No, not Bitcoin. I swear. No.
Yeah, I remember this cartoon.
Yeah, but this was on... was this on UPN or was this on...
This was on...
Because I know it eventually made the transition to WB.
That's because it was on WB and then they did a whole bunch of weird things.
Yeah, but like this was... fun. Like, I actually kind of enjoyed this one. I did. And I actually rewatched a few of the episodes, and they were still funny. Like, they were still good. I don't know who was behind it. Mind you, I'm still just a kid at heart, so I watched all that stuff all the time. But in terms of your preparation for this movie, Spence, what did you do, where does your history within this franchise lie?
No, because if we're going with preparation, I did no preparation for this.
Well, I know that much. That's why I had to reword that last statement. Like, all right, wait, preparation, no.
Hey,
what do you know about the franchise?
Mostly just like the first, well, mostly the first movie, because I've forgotten what happens in the second movie.
Uh-huh.
And like, I remember the TV show slightly. I remember in like the final episode, they neuralized the entire city of New York.
In the final episode?
Yeah.
Of?
Men in Black, the cartoon series.
Oh, well, I mean, they technically did that at the end of the second Men in Black.
I told you I didn't remember that.
But,
so.
I mean, it is what it is. I mean, hey, you know, just
yeah,
whatever.
Yeah. So, really, that's most of my, like, knowledge of this franchise is coming from the first Men in Black.
Well, I mean, and that's not a bad place to start,
no,
I guess.
It was a great movie.
It was a great movie. And like we talked about, it was like way ahead of its time in terms of the vibe. So you had, as we mentioned, the director, you had Barry Sonnenfeld, who was creating a unique world that wasn't like too heavy in the sci-fi, like the realistic sci-fi. It wasn't too focused on like, oh, these aliens, they look like these, you know, giant, you know, ancient Aztec looking creatures or beings or whatnot. It wasn't so heavily focused on like creating a sense of realism. It was like a fun fantastical world.
Yeah.
And the creatures, the aliens, all looked like something that I don't mean any disrespect when I say this, but like something that like maybe a 12-year-old would draw as an alien.
No, I get what you mean when you say that.
And it was fun. It was whimsical.
Yeah, it was
like,
good.
Even the scarier ones still looked like that kind of drawing. Like you look at the bad guy in the first film, this giant cockroach. He's literally a giant bug, and he still looks like his eyes, the way his body's shaped. He didn't really look menacing.
Yeah.
So since you didn't watch part two is essentially bringing back Tommy Lee Jones and
then at the end, mailman or something,
and Rosario Dawson's like the secret key person in this movie because she's the light of Zalthar or something, or Xanthar. She's the light that has to go back to her planet to be a princess, essentially.
Cool.
You know, the oh, it's always been inside of you all along, whatever kind of thing. So, and then, in all honesty, have you seen the third one?
No.
Okay.
I have not seen it at all.
I'm going to be really frank, and I know we're probably going to sidetrail it a little bit, but I really have to say, the third one is probably the best one out of all of them.
Really?
No doubt. I rewatched.
That's massively interesting.
I watched it a while back when it first came out, but I watched bits and pieces. So today, I rented it to watch it through one more time.
Mm-hmm.
I really, really wish we were covering that movie. Than Men in Black International, because Men in Black 3, so obviously the premise of that one is something happens and Jay has to go back in time to stop an alien from, who had also gone back in time, from changing history. And so he goes back and so forth. But the way the film has like its continuity and its story and the character arcs of certain particular people, it's really good. And the way it ties everything up, you're like, that's why they work so well as a team. And you're like, it just really wraps up that story for them really well. So I really think you should check it out if you get a chance.
Okay, I'll find it somewhere.
So Men in Black International, obviously, like we said, you have the two lead stars, Tessa Thompson and Chris Hemsworth. They essentially play two MIB agents who are trying to figure out this whole plot this invasion of this entity called the Hive. It's really interesting because, well, before I go into my thoughts, let's talk about expectations. Spence, what were some of your expectations going into this movie, knowing full well what you knew about the one movie you saw in the cartoon series?
How dare you? I had opinions. Really, though, I had no idea, like, what if they were even going to do like the Men in Black part right, because I hadn't seen the third one and I was kind of iffy on Will Smith around that time, and all of it's mostly because of After Earth. It came out around then, so I was like,
well, it's
name was true. Cypher Rage. No,
it was like the cheesiest Street Fighter you know.
So I was a bit concerned about that. I was kind of excited to see Chris Hemsworth and Tessa Thompson together, mm-hmm. because like I like how those two play off each other. Like they generally do a pretty good job.
Which they've played, you know, parts already together in Thor Ragnarok and also in Avengers Endgame.
Yeah.
In Thor Endgame, no. But they've done well already thus far in terms of working together.
So. Yeah, so like I was kind of pretty positive, like at least, you know, that duo dynamic should play out pretty nicely.
Yeah.
And that's kind of all I went in with.
Okay, yeah, I can see that. Like, for me, like one of the biggest things in terms of expectations for this particular movie was honestly seeing that like similar heart.
Mm, yeah.
Because the first three films, they all have this unique vibe, if you will. It's almost on the level of like Tim Burton-esque, but not quite like that dark. Like not even the color palettes, not that quite dark. It's a very fantastical and whimsical world that's still based in realism because it's still based in the modern day. Mm-hmm. But like I mentioned, like the character design and the way everything looks and the way everything feels, and like it just, it seems like everything, it seems like I'd be okay letting like a 13 or 14 year old watch it and be okay. Like that's how I felt with those types of movies, is the best way I guess I can put it. So the expectation was, I was hoping to see a lot of that. I was hoping to see the same care that went into the writing, because like I said, one was a great film, two, but like part three was phenomenal. Like I rented part three and it's still available in my Vudu. So I'm probably going to rewatch it again tonight, because it was that good. Like it was just, it was worth like taking a look at it. And so a lot of that hope and a lot of the expectations that I had were merely based in like the heart of the film, like the vibe and the writing, because the writing was fun. Mm-hmm. So, you know, like a lot of the scenes from the first film when they're trying to like, they're interrogating the wife of the woman whose husband's skin gets taken. And she's like, I wanted water, sugar water. And like, and he, the whole neuralizing episode where he's trying to, you know, reshape her memory, and like, and you need to redecorate in this room, because like that whole thing was, it was hilarious. So that's what I was hoping in terms of expectations for me in that movie, which a lot of that vibe that came from those movies, it was really helped out a lot by like the work of Danny Elfman. Like Danny Elfman did the score for The Nightmare Before Christmas. And actually Danny Elfman and Tim Burton did a lot of movies together. Mm-hmm. So to know that
they like gel together really well.
Well, cause it fits.
Yeah.
Like you have the macabre look of, you know, Tim Burton in all of his movies, and you have just this almost child horror, like horror house type sound coming out of Danny Elfman. And it's like, oh, that's cool. It's like this off kind of carnival music type sounding, you know, music that he's creating, and it works. So you have it in, you know, in place of like this. Like I think it would have been a whole different type of vibe had the music been done by like Chris Columbus, who you'd made that same face last week when we were talking about Hans Zimmer, and I said Christopher Columbus, and you were like, wait, not the explorers.
Well, no, now I was like, isn't he a director though?
Chris Columbus?
Yeah.
I thought he did some of the music too.
Did he?
I don't know. Well, his his movies all have the same sounding type scores. But needless to say, like those types of scores, they're very like, very upbeat, very family oriented.
Mm-hmm.
You look at Hans Zimmer. Hans Zimmer's very, you know, deep and methodical. There's a lot of consideration that goes into his scores. Danny Elfman makes this franchise feel the way it does in terms of that whimsy and that lightheartedness. You know, like even though the world's about to end, I'm still having a good time kind of thing.
Yeah. Yeah, he's real good at that.
So diving right in, obviously this film, we're going to be talking about spoilers. So if you haven't seen it, we will try to keep the spoilers to a minimum. But in all honesty, it's one of those types of movies where the biggest spoiler is what happens at the end. So you don't really kind of... We'll announce when the spoilers hit. We'll let you know.
Okay.
But honestly, the film opens up. You have the scene that you see in the trailer where the little girl is... you know, watching her parents getting neuralized because there's a sound in the basement, and it happens to be this alien creature that's actually on the loose.
No, I thought the film started in Paris, and then went to... It should have started with her.
It should have started with her, because it starts in, like, Because I don't think that took place 20 years ago. That would have made Chris Hemsworth like way much older than...
That has too many questions. It starts in 2016, then jumps back to 1996 before jumping forward to 2019.
Yeah.
Which I was like, okay, that's really rapid to just be changing time periods.
Yeah, because it's like you're doing one time jump, and then you're doing a second time jump, and then you're doing a third time jump back to the present day.
Yeah, just do it in order.
Yeah. So Spence is actually right. It does open with like Liam Neeson, who is an agent at the time, and his partner, who happens to be Chris Hemsworth, going and facing this threat that is happening at the Eiffel Tower. Mm-hmm. And in the midst of that, you just find out that the Hive is coming and that they have to defeat the Hive. And that's literally where it establishes that whole premise, like, oh, the Hive is coming. We're the last line of defense for the Earth, you know, blah, blah, blah. And then it cuts to the 20-year one or whatever year, 1920.
Going back.
And it goes back to when Tessa Thompson's character, Molly, was a little girl and her parents, the whole scene that you see in the trailer, parents get neuralized, but they don't neuralize the little girl. And she lets a alien free because it was trying to get out. It's a little soft, furry little thing. Was it just me, or did it look a lot like the alien from the Rick and Morty episode where Morty ends up having a baby alien?
It's almost that present whole episode, except it happens a lot faster in Rick and Morty.
It is.
Gazorpazorp.
Yes, Gazorpazorp. That's right. That's what it looked like. And I'm like, I wonder if like any of the people from that team knows, like, Dan, what's his name, Dan Harmon?
Mm-hmm.
Dan Harmon and Justin Roiland have seen this movie yet, because it looks a lot like Morty's Baby. But let's hope it wasn't made the same.
Oh, my gosh.
And so after that scene, you get a flash forward to the present day where Tessa Thompson's applying for all these different places. She's applying to the FBI. She's applying to the CIA. And every time she applies, she's always asking for the quote-unquote department that is not listed, or the department that deals with things that are, you know, from, as she points up, like up there, and one unique interviewer, it's like, oh, you mean accounting? And so I was like, that's a swing and a miss. But oddly, it establishes the fact that Tessa Thompson's character becomes obsessed with figuring out this other side of the law that governs the extraterrestrial part of this universe and how it protects our world and whatnot. Simultaneously, you also come to realize that this movie does spend a little too much time on Tessa Thompson, like trying to find that whole, you know, trying to find MIB, because it almost seems like in between her search, she goes and works at the place of what is that movie you made me watch?
Oh, Regal View.
Sorry not to bother you.
Yeah,
yeah. It looks like she ends up working over there for a one point. I'm like,
she's
oh.
just hopping into her other movies.
Yeah, I'm like, yeah. Can we just film this here? I'm doing the same thing. Can we just do this here? So that's what that kind of reminded me of. I mean, overall, essentially, you come to find out that she's picked up by MIB, she's recruited, send her to London, there's an issue, there's a mole, they have to go and figure it out.
Okay, well, wait. They didn't, like, specify all that to her, like, initially.
No.
They're like, there's a problem in London.
There's a problem in London.
With no stipulations of what that might be. And to move just back a little more, I actually kind of like the whole, like, looking for the Men in Black thing, because, like...
Yeah, but a lot of it was just... So here's my issue.
Hmm.
They they really pushed the whole idea, like, in her search and everything. There was a little bit too heavy on the sense of realism in terms of just in the beginning settings that made the whole scene where she ends up, like, turning her telemarketing desktop area into, like, a UFO tracking system. And I'm like, unless she's like, and mind you, this is going to the nth degree of, like, figuring out and trying to make sense of it and using too much technical jargon, but unless she like VPN'd into her desktop at home.
I pretty much assumed she was doing that.
That's the thing. You and I know that. That makes sense. That's the realism. Like, I'm like, how is she doing that on company time? Like, isn't she like killing her like CPU? Like, that's a lot of, that's a lot of.
No, you can do it. Like, on, a modern computer can do this.
On her setup that she had at her work, they were doing like simple whatever repairs over the phone. With people who, it reminded me of one of my first jobs when I had to talk to people on how to, you know, do desktop repair for their receivers for satellite. It's like, no, ma'am, just unplug it and plug it back in. But I think the issue for me was that because of a lot of the way it began to traverse in the beginning, it just seemed like, okay, they're going to have a little bit heavier sense of realism in here, which I it is proved right as the film progresses. Because even as you have the situation where she is sent to London, because according to Emma Thompson, there is a quote unquote problem in London.
Correct.
At that moment, you are, you know, you're transitioned to another scene where they're actually in London and, or no, they're not in London. They're in like Morocco or they're somewhere.
Marrakesh.
That's right. And Chris Hemsworth is essentially doing the worst job at being on a stakeout. Like, I would say that was probably the worst. If he was trying, not even F for effort, like lower than that, because he's completely out of, you know, he doesn't look like he's trying to hide it, but he's acting like he is. And I don't know if it's like they're just trying to play on his like ineptitude or his ability to just be like, oh, forget it, I don't care, whatever, I'm just here to do whatever. Like, even to the point to where he gets bit by this, I guess, this venomous creature, and is now begging for the anti-venom, which it only goes in his favor because of the fact that the creature that bit him, he threw it at the other guy that was about to kill him, and it bites the other guy. But the only person with the anti-venom is this snake-like alien who has it and is dating or is married to or whatever to the main bad guy.
Yeah.
But he tells her that if she saves him, he'll do whatever she wants. And she goes, anything? And he goes, anything? And the next scene you see is like them waking up in bed together.
And at this point, I was like, this never would have happened to Kay.
Never in a million years.
Nope.
And at that point, I was just like, okay, this is definitely not in the same heart, if you will. It doesn't have that same vibe as the previous trilogy. Because that right away just lets me know, like, okay, well, I don't know if, like, Men in Black operate in the mindset of, like, all right, I'm going to do whatever it takes, even if it means sacrificing my own body like this. Like, I feel like that's a very, compromising police department or detective agency.
Oh, no, that's exactly what this is. Like, this is, like, a very realistic, like, what if Men in Black existed in more of a real sense?
Exactly. Yeah. And that just didn't sit well for me, like, because I'm like, one of the things that Chris Hemsworth always gets, like, you know, pigeonholed, and I say pigeonholed because it's been like that in every single movie he's been in. Just about. I haven't seen what is that, The Heart of the Sea or whatever, the one where he plays the whaler. But like in every other movie that he appears in, he's always in it for the simple fact of his appearance, like how he looks, his boyish looks, his charm, like all those things. That's actually what he gets hired on for, because he's a body. His acting is tentatively the same way in every movie that I've seen him in. Like, he plays this somewhat egotistical, with a heart of gold, blondie, you know, who's got muscles and whatnot, and will eventually come around at the end of the film.
Yeah.
Like, I mean, has there ever been a film with where he's not that?
No. Like, I'm trying to think, but I don't believe so.
And it's not that, here's the thing, it's not that I'm, like, it's not that I'm talking down against this person. If that's your role, I mean, by all means, if that's...
Yeah, if you're good at what you do and it's that, then roll with it.
Exactly. And he's done well in all the other films. It's just, it's the same, you know, the same character, the same individual. Looking at just everything that he's been in, you know, from from The Cabin in the Woods to The Avengers, Snow White and the Huntsman, every Thor film, every Marvel film, essentially, the Vacation movie.
Well, I guess technically he wasn't like that in Ghostbusters, kind of.
Yeah, he was. He was a
wasn't egotistical. He was dumb.
He was aware that he was pretty.
Okay,
that's why.
A lot of people are aware they're pretty without being egotistical.
I can give you that, but either way, like, it still feels like very much. I don't know. It just doesn't feel like there's much else to him. I mean, except for his role in Bad Times at the El Royale.
Ooh, that was a good one.
Yeah, where, mind you, he does stretch a little bit more of his role and his acting chops, to where he's really like just this loathsome character. Mind you, he is still shirtless most of the time.
Yeah, but to be fair, that does kind of feel like that character, though. Like, that character doesn't believe in shirts.
That's very true. Very true. So, I mean, okay, 95% of the time that's his role in these movies.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, is that? Do you think that's safe to assume? Like, 95% of his roles in his career tend to veer towards the side of like that.
Yeah, going back, just like looking at his IMDb page, kind of have to lean towards you with this one.
Yeah.
Because there's a lot of, like, you know, roles that are like that.
Yeah.
And just a few that aren't.
And mind you, it would be one thing if we were not speaking the truth and there was things that we were missing. Like, if you totally don't agree, like, no, you're missing a movie. He actually was, like, super insightful and in the heart of the sea, and, you know, he actually wore like a, you know, heavy clothes, so you never got to see his chest or whatever. I don't know. Like, some of the ones I'm thinking about, like 12 Strong. Remember when we went to go see 12 Strong?
Vaguely.
That was that one about
the horse people.
The horse soldiers. That's right. I mean, there's that one, Bad Times at the El. Well, no, we actually checked that one off. Like, but In the Heart of the Sea, probably. Yeah, that's about it.
Hmm.
Like, I can't really think of anything else. You know, it is what it is. But on the opposite side of that spectrum, I mean, Tessa Thompson, she was unique. Like, I don't think she's been in enough movies yet to create like this profile of like how she portrays herself, because you got everything from what's that movie? Creed.
Uh-huh. Like, the movies, like Creed and Thor Ragnarok and this movie, those are all different characters. And,
yeah,
like, she has a different range than what Chris Hemsworth is pulling off.
Well, and even then, in Annihilation, I don't know if you had seen Annihilation, but that was that.
Oh, yeah, she was in that one.
She was in that one, but she played a scientist, and which was phenomenal. She was great in that one. She plays, like, this executive person in Westworld, which was great as well.
Oh.
She's done a lot. I'm trying to think. You know, but they're not. They take a little bit from each particular character that she's done, but it's not like this cookie cutter mold that she's always been. Like, take for instance the one I was just mentioning earlier, Sorry to Bother You. Like, that her role in that one was like everything from, I thought she was cool at one point, to the part where I was like, oh my God, she needs to die or something. Like, she's horrible. Like, it really...
Is that at her art gallery? What part was that?
Well, that's at several parts. At the art gallery, or when she's cheating on her boyfriend with Glenn from The Walking Dead, or...
Weren't they on a break or something like that?
Okay, Ross, take it easy over there. They were on a break! But... I mean, the idea that her character portrayal in each of these films never seems to be the same.
Mm-hmm.
It's really a great way to continue like your career right now. Like I was saying, her role in Sorry to Bother You is completely different than her role in the Creed movies.
Yeah.
You know, but then you look at the Creed movies And those are completely different than her Thor Ragnarok, you know, in the Marvel films, like different characters. So I think it's safe to say, like, she does strong really well, and she knows how to do both loud and quiet strength.
Yeah.
And I really have to commend her. Like, in Annihilation, she does quiet strength so well. And she does it, you know, extremely, you know, artful and tasteful. It's very, you know, very beautiful to watch in that particular movie, which I believe we actually covered as soon as we figure out what episode that was.
You brought it up and you didn't even have it ready.
I always have things ready. What are you talking about? I know not what you... But... but nevertheless, that particular movie, those movies, all the things that she's done in terms of films, it's always, you know, astounding. It's always like really incredible work, and it's never the same, like we said. So it's, I have to give it to her. I'm hoping that it doesn't, you know, cease, and at one point in time she's like, oh, I'm going to start doing the same character now from here on out over and over and over.
That would actually be a shame.
It would completely be a shame, because it's like, with everything that she's done thus far, where's the consistency, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So I'm trying to find it and not finding it.
Oh my gosh, you're still looking for that.
Leave me alone.
We're going to look like we don't know what we're doing without Chad.
Because we don't know what we're doing without Chad. So, yeah, I mean, there's that. Other people, like, I have to say, as okay, as great as she did, and so as great as she did, and okay, Chris Hemsworth did, I'm going to have to really kind of break the mold here and say, like, my most outstanding role in this film was Kumail Nanjiani's character of the little guy.
Really? He was the standout character for you?
I laughed every time he opened his mouth. I kid you not. I was like, he is hilarious. Can I have some more, please?
He's okay.
He was not okay. He was better than okay. He was phenomenal.
I was worried that he was going to be the annoying little sidekick. He was really good in some parts, but like, he was all right.
He was all right.
Yeah.
He was good. Like, everything that he was doing added the... So everything that you're used to with Chris Hemsworth, it's not overdone in, you know, it's not to the point to where it's like, he's doing this again or whatever, because it breaks up with a lot of what she's doing, which is great.
Mm-hmm.
I like that. Simultaneously, instead of having Tessa Thompson become overly, like, because she was at a great level of like her funny, her comedic takes, the things that she would say, it was at a great level how many she was delivering,
mm-hmm.
but it wasn't to the point to where I was getting tired of hearing her trying to say things like that, because she had the buffer of the little guy. Pawnee is his name in the film.
Yeah, that's a good point.
Like, take for instance, there's a scene where they are stuck in the desert.
That was actually one of my favorites with them. Okay.
And they're stuck in the desert, and they are trying to work on this bike, and they had both just gotten into an argument, and so they are trying to work on this, you know, alien-type bike together without talking to each other, because they're totally not talking to each other. So he would say, Pawnee, tell her that whatever, blah, blah, blah. And he would say, oh, the big dumb idiot wants to know, blah, blah, blah. And she would go, tell him, blah, 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 blah. He goes, my queen says you're a jerk and you're this and that and blah, 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 blah. And if you can do this. And it was like, it was great, because it was hilarious. That made for like a great break in the heavy storyline, the heavier part of the storyline that the film was heading towards. Which, mind you, as we mentioned, this film lies heavily a lot in realism.
Yeah.
So a lot of the aspects where you would almost see like a Bourne identity type film, or even even like a John Wick. John Wick is a great example. John Wick 3, which we just reviewed recently. That particular movie had John going all over the place. John Wick Chapter 3, by the way, is lesson 162 if you're playing at home.
We're back online.
Whatever. But like, you look at that and it's like, okay, he's going there, he's doing this, he's doing those things. Okay, that makes sense. But the way this film feels when it goes to these places, it feels a lot like there's like a espionage feel to it. There's a sense of like, okay, this is based heavily in realism. This is based in not like a Mission Impossible type feel rather than a Men in Black type feel.
Yeah, I know what you're saying, especially like where one part of the movie is it turns out that Chris Hemsworth's character had a past relationship with someone who was an arms dealer.
Yeah.
Which I was like, how has no one in Men in Black monitored anything this guy has done?
Which they're monitoring everything within the alien universe, and the arms dealer happens to be an alien. So you would assume, all right, they have like a dossier on like even romantic partners or whatever. Wouldn't Chris Hemsworth come up? And I think Tessa Thompson points out, like, doesn't that make this a conflict of interest?
It really does. Like, it's that was like the part where I was like, what's happening? Because yeah. I don't understand how this whole thing should fit into like a Men in Black movie.
Yeah. Or at least within this franchise, because it didn't really seem like it was trying to be in the same universe that's already been established. Like, it wanted to say, okay, we're a part of that, but we're not directly in that one. Like, almost like a parallel universe type.
Well, you could just call that a different country, I suppose. We're part of this, but not really.
And that must be what Alaska is saying in this entire... we're a part of this. We're just... just the distance is fine. But, I mean, it takes away a lot of the fun when it does a lot of that, where what should be lighthearted and whimsical becomes...
very serious.
Very serious. And even the conversations turn that way, like, really quick. Like, at least with Men in Black, the conversations that were in that vein of, like, seriousness or even the depth of the conversation, it still leans to a lighthearted outcome in that conversation. Like, yeah. If the conversation starts it that way, there's usually an outro of it that leads to something more lighthearted or possibly to the bigger picture of lightheartedness. Where in this one, you're just like, so you've never been in love. And she's like, well, I've never had time or whatever. And he's like, then you won't know. But I'm like, oh my gosh. My heart, please be still. But those types of things. And then, I think one of the biggest things that pushed me out of this movie so many times was its deep dive back into like, oh, by the way, let's establish we're in a real world. We're having this situation happen in a real world. I don't know. What did you think about that?
Just the fact that they were acting in a real world. Like, they played real fast and loose with that rule, like, when it suited them. Because, like, there was points where it's like, there are all these people. We got to neuralize them. And then there'd be other points where they'd just be like, whatever. I don't have time for that. I've got to fly away on my motor hover bike thing. And so it's weird, I suppose, that they're just not treating things consistently the same. They're like, it's like they can't decide what kind of movie this Men in Black movie should be. Is it like more serious or more fun?
Yeah, is this going to be
like
it
keeps toggling rapidly back and forth between those two states.
True, because like you're either at one point where you're like, okay, this is going to be like a Bourne Identity movie in an alien universe, or is this going to be like an actual Men in Black film that carries the lightheartedness? And because I can be honest with you, like the way this film continues on, like, mind you, yes, most of the Men in Black films, there was maybe a curse word here or there, whatnot.
Mm-hmm.
But this one just seemed to have not a lot, but a few more than normal, which they weren't used in, like, I don't know, just the way they were used, it just seemed much different.
Mm.
And that kind of, not that I'm opposed to like having, I mean, if it's a part of the dialogue, if it pushes the story forward, I mean, you could have put, you know, Russian in there for all I care. And if it made sense to the overall story, then fine. But like the idea that this film uses it more of an accentuation, like a punctuation rather than a part of the dialogue, it was, Another thing that really kind of stood out to me for this particular movie was, how like compact the story felt. Like, I didn't feel like the story spanned the universe. I felt like this story spanned the smallness of like practically the car that they were in and the small spaces, like places you've already been to.
Yeah. A lot of it seemed to stem from the things that like things were coming to them for the most part versus them having to go to things. Because like, I remember in the first one, like Will Smith and Tommy Lee were like just all over the place having to go from place to place to like find out what was happening. And like, while they're still doing that somewhat here, like international, like intergalactic arms dealers are all just like flocking to Earth like right now because things are happening.
Yeah, and that was really weird. I just didn't get like, is that something that naturally is like?
Also, it seems like if you're an arms dealer, you like probably wouldn't want to go to Earth because like. Men in Black's around, but if they're all like Chris Hemsworth, I guess there's nothing to really be scared of, so I don't really know.
Right, because apparently you just sleep with Chris Hemsworth and that's your pass.
Yeah.
You know, from Men in Black. and mind you, there were highlights of the film, as we mentioned, like the overall story was unique. The difference between this one and the other ones is there's a mole in MIB, and it is very... As small as the cast is, which, mind you, the cast of extras, there was numerous, but like the primary cast, like the principal cast, if you will, it was only a few people, like Tessa Thompson, Chris Hemsworth, Emma Thompson, Liam Neeson, and whoever played some agent that I didn't even catch his name. Agent C.
Oh, Rafe Spall?
Sure. We'll go with that.
Is this how you pronounce his name?
But like those guys, Rafe Spall. Oh my gosh, that is his name.
Yeah. I wasn't making up a name.
Well, my bad. I don't know these things. but like you have all that, and then of course, obviously with, what's his name? Kumail Nanjiani.
Mm-hmm.
Nanjiani. There's not really many people to guess who the mole is, because
that was not even a guessing game. Like, did you seriously not know who it was within the first 2 minutes of this movie starting?
Which we're not gonna say who the mole is. We're just,
you're gonna figure it out.
You it is pretty easy to figure out. Which, mind you, if it takes you longer, then by all means, I hope you have a grand time with that story and trying to figure it out. But like, it is pretty obvious who it is, right from the get-go. It was kind of a bummer to see how quickly I surmised that that's the mole. Like, okay, all right, well, okay. Because in all honesty, like, that particular character was doing all the like stereotypical mole things. I don't know if you have. Have you seen Men in Black 3?
No.
I'm sorry, not Men in Black.
Talked about it.
Sorry, Mission Impossible 3.
No.
So,
we also talked about that.
I know we did. I just wanted to get it on record again. So in Mission Impossible 3, there is a mole within IMF.
This place have moles.
Well, this is, I don't know. Maybe it's a, I have no idea. But like, the idea of who the mole is like almost instantaneous once you meet this person, because like, oh, well, that, okay, yeah, you're not on the level. Like, that's kind of how this worked out. Like, you're seeing this and you're like, oh yeah, that character's not on the level, you know.
And the weird thing is they brought in a red herring like way too late.
They did.
And I was like, why is this guy even here when I know it's just supposed to be, what if it's this guy?
Or that girl.
It's none of them.
Oh my gosh. So yeah, I mean, it's like I said, overall, I think one of the biggest things that I do have to appreciate about this movie is the story structure. I did like the way the overall story idea was built. But it's execution, because that's the difference. Like, the way it was built up to be, like, the grand idea, and then the execution are two different things.
Okay, now I'm fine.
And the story structure, I felt, was strong. I thought it was worth, like, really looking into. In fact, it could have probably been explored a little bit deeper. Could have been a little bit more fun. But the execution of it just seemed to fall on its face. Like, okay, you got this green Men in Black agent who goes on this, you know, very cryptic mission to work in London to solve a problem in MIB, air quotes there, and is thrust into, just happened to be thrust into this case that just falls into her lap because the ranking agent needed somebody to pimp out to the guy that they were supposed to be protecting. And then ultimately, you know, just collapsing into this story of like them on the run, not really doing anything productive, really. Like, yeah, none of it was productive at all. And then ending in probably one of the more anticlimactic last battles of the film, because it just, it happens in an instant. It's not very long, right, maybe like 5-10 minutes.
Mm-hmm.
So yeah.
Yeah.
And even the way the film ends, like, it's very like, oh, just a reminder, real life sucks. So, you know, when you make friends at summer camp and you say goodbye, it's probably going to be for the last time. So this is what this is going to show you, that life happens. Like, they both got to go their separate ways.
Okay, but like, that doesn't mean anything in this reality where you can take a train from New York to London in like 4 minutes.
That is pretty true.
Like, it's so
literally
trivial.
Like, up the road. Like, hey, what are you doing today? Oh, I'm just getting up for breakfast. Oh, right, I'm going to have dinner. You want to come over?
Yeah, see,
oh,
that sure. was the thing at the end of the movie when it's like, oh, we're breaking up the team. I'm like, why is this a problem?
Like seriously, unless there's like some large amount of paperwork that has to be filled out so that you can go to the other side of the ocean. When you have the technology, we have the technology, you know? I don't know.
No, it's weird.
Because then that goes back to the idea of, like, the film wanting to be based in a sense of realism. Like, why? There's so much more that you could be doing with your time in terms of, like, oh, you can create, you know, a more flexible type of ending or a more ambiguous type of ending. Or you can create, like, I don't know, go back to the beginning and just make this movie more fun.
Mm.
Because as entertaining as certain performances were, the overall film was kind of lacking.
Yeah.
Like, I didn't really have that great of a time. Like, it was okay. But
really, this film needed, like, more bounce, more of a fun vibe overall. Like, I kind of would have changed Chris Hemsworth to be more of, like, the, hey, I'm the hotshot guy, and I know all the ropes, and I'm going to show you stuff, and, like, just, like, crazy adventure from crazy adventure type thing.
True. No, so much more, because... And like I said, that suits him a little bit more.
Yeah.
Like, that hits more on the head of the nail than, like, oh, this, you know, all-star agent who was once this but then has totally changed and everybody can see it and he doesn't see it. And then you think it's because he broke up with his arms dealer because he's talking about love, which is ridiculous because it doesn't even make sense because it wasn't even true. But then you find out it's something bigger and it's like, like the reveal of what is really wrong with him.
Plus, you could still keep the, like, my hotshot idea and still have that. Because, yeah, like, that problem is just glazed over for most of the movie.
Yeah, he's got, like, this dysfunction within him, like, this negative self-image or whatever, this self-deprecating manner of, oh, well, you know, I know I used to be whatever, but blah, 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 blah. It's like,
Yeah, and I also don't understand what's going on with him as he is now.
Yeah.
Why is he even, like, in this rut? Because he shouldn't be. He just, like, decided one day, oh, I'm not going to be awesome. That's what it seems like, and I don't fully understand what's happening with him.
Yeah. So, I don't know. What about you? Any last thoughts?
I miss Will Smith and Louis Jones. When I heard that opening intro music with, like, Men in Black International sign and, like, that, like, Men in Black theme, not the Will Smith one, but, like, you know, the Danny Elfman one. Yeah, I was like, I kind of hope they just make, like, even a background appearance would make me happy.
It would have been interesting. And mind you, it's the vibe is trying to be within that original universe, especially with the help of Danny Elfman, but it doesn't quite hit that mark of being in that whimsical, like, playful type environment. And even in those other films, when there was a worldwide threat or universal threat, there was still this sense of whimsy. There was still this sense of, like, okay, this is a fantastical story. There's some fun added to it. There's some little bit of joy. There's, you know, hilarity going that's going to ensue. This is how confused this movie is. There's a joke in the movie where Kunal, why do I keep forgetting his name?
Nanjiani.
Kumail Nanjiani was just discovered by the two agents in the back room, and all the people are gone. They're all the other chess pieces, including his queen. They're all dead, and he's, you know, kind of at this place where he's like, oh, I have no reason to live. I'm gonna run my sword through myself, blah blah blah, like this. I'm gonna cut my throat. I'm gonna do it. And the joke is, Chris Hemsworth saying, like, Tessa Thompson's like, well, aren't you gonna stop him? And he's like, actually, no. I want to see if he's gonna go through with it. I'm like, okay, well, that's the badoonts. Like,
dark.
Like, exactly. It's like, what's. Because then it tries to do, like, this little bit of levity with his character, with Kamal's character, but it's not, like, it doesn't hit right. Like,
because the joke is suicide.
Exactly. So, I mean, that for me kind of epitomizes the confusion this movie has in trying to portray a project or a film that is a part of a certain universe, but not exactly from that particular universe.
Mm-hmm.
Anything else you want to add before we wrap up?
No, I've made mention of my miss of original actors, so no, I think I'm pretty good.
Liam Neeson's not in this movie enough to give really an idea. Like, he's in it for, like,
you know, I would have actually liked to see more of both Liam Neeson and
Emma Thompson.
Yeah, Emma Thompson.
Which, by the way, Emma Thompson is introduced in Men in Black 3.
Oh, really?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So, a little bit of information there for you to. You should really see it.
Okay.
So wrapping this conversation up, let's go ahead and go round the table, which there's only two of us, so let's just going across the table and talk about whether or not this film passes or fails and how many monocles spends. Let's go ahead and start.
See, this is where we get into the troubling part of this whole exercise of grading a movie. Because, like, if you're talking about a general movie, it does pass as a general movie, but it kind of fails to be a Men in Black movie, which I feel is kind of important.
Yeah.
So
meshing those two, where do you come?
Well, that comes into this odd space of passing and failing, and I feel like I keep doing that a lot. So I guess I'm gonna fail this movie.
Okay.
But I'm also going to give it, like, 3 monocles. Because, like, you can tell there's a lot of effort and people are trying. I just don't feel like they're meeting up with where they need to be when you say, oh, this is a Men in Black movie.
No, I completely agree.
Yeah.
In like manner, I have that same, you know, discussion within my mind, and I'm actually going to pass it for the fact that as a film in itself, it does create a complete project, if you want to call it that.
Yeah.
And it's been hailed as a spin-off, not so much as a part, like a continued sequel. So
right.
I'm going to just give it that benefit of the doubt and say, all right, well, I can see where they're trying with that. So that's fine. In terms of monocles, I'm actually going to give it 3 as well.
Okay.
2 for Pawnee, because he's great, and 1 for Tessa Thompson.
Okay.
Everything else can just suck it. So... there wasn't really much
cool
else. But I mean, who knows, maybe on like a second viewing when it comes out on Fox Saturday morning or
Fox Saturday morning.
I don't know, do they still do like Sunday afternoon movies on Fox?
I don't think so. Everyone has Netflix or something.
I'll wait till it hits Netflix then, give it a second viewing. So So, but that about wraps up another episode of The Filmlosophers. Remember, you can let us know, have you checked out the film lately? What did you think? Do you agree? Do you disagree? Let us know your thoughts on our Facebook page at facebook.com/filmlosophers or our Twitter page at twitter.com/filmlosophy101. Before we go, we want to let you know of a couple upcoming weekend releases. You got Anna. You have the 2019 reboot of Child's Play. And on a lighter note, you have Toy Story 4. So
two things real quick. What, Chucky looks terrifying.
He looks horrible.
I don't like it. Like,
and then on top of that, he's voiced by Mark Hamill. So that's always fun.
Well, Mark Hamill does a good job. But I'm going to miss what's his face from the other ones.
Brad Dourif?
Yeah.
It's true.
He does Creepy really well.
Yeah. As we said, that wraps up another conversation. So, from all of us here at the Filmlosophers, I'm Eddie.
I'm Spence.
Class dismissed.